Welcome to Worlds Apart. My way or the highway seems like a very limiting and rather bare-knuckle choice, and yet, as the rivalry between China and the United States gathers momentum, it's increasingly being pushed on nations in Asia and beyond. Where is the continent likely to pivot as the drive to both upset and benefit from its development intensifies? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Gita Wirjawan, an Indonesian entrepreneur and the country's former Minister of Trade. Mr. Wirjawan, it's amazing to have you on the show. Thank you very much for this privilege and for this pleasure.
Likewise, it's an honor for me to be here.
I know you're very passionate about the rise of Southeast Asia, and you make the case that this could be done by leaning on China for technology and on the United States for economic capital. And it sounds like having the best of both worlds. Who wouldn't want that? And yet, as this rivalry between China and the United States gathers momentum, are you sure relying on both of them will still be possible?
Well, I think there is a recognition by quite a number of people in Southeast Asia that it is a region of scale with 700 million people and with a relatively sizable economy at around $4 trillion worth of goods and services. And historically, the region has been able to embrace multipolarity in a pretty dexterous manner. It's you know, amplified and punctuated, I think, in 1955, when we made a public exhortation alongside Chou Enlai, Nasser, and Nehru in Bandung, for the Asia-Africa conference that would have led up to the foundation for the Non-Aligned Movement in 1961. That, I think, is a manifestation of the region's ability and willingness to embrace a multipolar order in the world. Now, as it relates to our desire to look at China increasingly more for technological capital, it's on the basis of two things. Number one, the economies of Southeast Asia at an individual country level, they're still developing. They're well below, you know, the $13,250 per capita per year, with the exception of two countries only, of course, Singapore and Brunei. So at the rate that some countries in Southeast Asia even earn less than $2,000, they, I think, would look at China more as a technological capital allocator because China has been providing technology much more cost efficiently and much more cost effectively. And the U.S., unfortunately, or the West, unfortunately, has not been deploying economic capital, even though they've, been sitting on massive liquidity, which has not gotten diversified out to many places around the world, including Southeast Asia. So the onus, I think, is on Southeast Asia's ability to, you know, better promote rule of law and better, you know, translate from uncertainties to risk, which would allow for capital allocation.
You make a very rational and very natural case to some extent. And I have no doubt about the, Asian propensity for multipolarity. But I think we also have to recognize the realities of current geopolitics. And the Americans are pretty straightforward about wanting not only undermine China's own rise, but also its trade and industrial links with other nations through the so-called transshipment tariffs and other policies. And I think it has to be also noted that this policy of trying to disrupt China's rise seems to have bipartisan support. So I wonder if sooner or later nations in your part of the world will be left with no other choice but to choose one side or the other. And what would it be in this case?
I still believe that geopolitically, geostrategically, geographically, Southeast Asia has optionalities as to deal with not just China and the West, but any other parts of the world. Given our nature, that just seems like a natural interlocutor between two differing worlds. Call it China and the West, call it Islam and the West, call it one part of the world and the other part of the world. Not to mention the scale of 700 million people. And it's been proven in the last, I would argue, 2,000 years in our ability to be graced by different civilizational forces, different economic forces, different religious forces, while maintaining tremendous degree of peace and stability, relatively speaking here. Going forward, I think, you know, it didn't stop us from joining the BRICS on the 6th of January for Indonesia. And it also didn't stop us from being able to cut a deal with the U.S. as much as the tariff, you know, imposition would have been at a slightly higher level than we would have aspired. But I think that shows the dexterity with which not only Indonesia can exercise, but I think Southeast Asia, you know, has and will be able to exercise going forward.
Mm-hmm. Now, structurally speaking, China is centralized politically, but decentralized economically, while for many Asian nations, the reverse is true. They pride themselves on being democracies in the Western sense of the world, but their economic development cannot keep up with that of China. Do you think that kind of arrangement is conducive to the kind of growth that you are imagining for the region?
No, I think you're absolutely right. It is paradoxical that China as a political entity is centralized, but its economic activities are highly decentralized. This has been alluded to by, you know, many famous economists around the world, including Kei Yu Jin. And you know, you aptly pointed out that, you know, many democracies around the world, not just in Southeast Asia, politically are decentralized, but have not been able to decentralize economic activities the scale, the way they should have. This is, I think, something that needs to be remedied going forward. This is, I think, not the path forward for anybody that wants to be a democracy. And democracy cannot just be manifested in distribution of power, but it has to be manifested in the distribution of public goods, including, of course, welfare, healthcare, intellect, education, social value, and moral value. So that I think is a much more refined definition of what a democracy ought to be like for not just those in Southeast Asia, but many around the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes when I interview Asian intellectuals, they invariably mention two aspirations, moving up the value, the global value chain, and having more geopolitical influence. And I wonder if those are still worthy pursuits given the tumultuous nature of both globalization and geopolitics.
They are. I think they're of nobility. You know, as for us to still pursue, I can speak for Southeast Asia, you know, the educational attainment divergence is so pervasive, which correlates with the economic attainment divergence. And this, I think, needs to be remedied if we are resolute in wanting to move up the value chain and wanting to move up the global geopolitical order. I would argue that I think Southeast Asia has every capacity, every, you know, desire to move from the periphery to the core of global consciousness only if we can move up the value chain and we can move up the global geopolitical order. Now, in order to do all those, I think we've got to take a strong view with respect to our education or, you know, the educational divergence. You have only two countries in Southeast Asia that have surpassed the PISA global average. This is the attainment for the 15-year-olds in the context of lingual proficiency and STEM proficiency. And out of the 10,000 universities in Southeast Asia, you only have two universities that are in the top 20 in the world. And those two happen to be in Singapore. Clearly, you know, that speaks of, I think, the academic attainment or educational attainment divergence, which needs to be remedied. Once we can remedy that, I think we can start moving up the value chain and the global geopolitical order.
Can I press on this question a little bit? Because I come from a country that used to believe in all that, but then had to move very quickly to self-sufficiency. Because once you have some clout geopolitically, it may not run well with other parts of the world. And, you know, they are using those interlinkages as a weapon to hit you where you are most sensitive. Now, Southeast Asia is a different example. It's a vast continent. you know, it's a different civilizational ground as well, as opposed to Russia and the West, let's say. But are you sure that this logic of, you know, being invested in, you know, moving up the global value chain, in investing in globalization, when globalization itself can be used against you, is it still there, or do you think maybe it has to be adjusted somewhat?
Well, it depends on time frame and it depends on definition, right? I'm in the camp that believes that moving up the global geopolitical order doesn't necessarily have to be the primacy, doesn't have to mean supremacy. You know, it just means relevance, you know, having a seat at the table as for us to be consulted, you know, on matters that matter to humanity. I don't think ASEAN or Southeast Asia is at that level yet. And that, I think, relates to many things, one of which is the inability to, you know, educate ourselves to the levels that we're seeing in China, that we're seeing in Russia, that we're seeing in the U.S., that we're seeing in South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and all the rest. We're not there yet. And that I think is empirically manifested in how there's only 375,000 publications about Southeast Asia in the context of about 140 million publications all around the world. It just means that, you know, for a region with 700 million people that represents 9% of the global population, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be narrated only to the extent of 0.27% of all publications. Mm-hmm. So I think we've got our work cut out, you know, before we can start thinking about attaining some sort of primacy or supremacy when it comes to the global geopolitical order. I think relevance is the more operative word here.
Okay, well, let's take a very short break to ponder this idea, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Gita Wirjawan, an Indonesian entrepreneur and the country's former Minister of Trade. Mr. Wirjawan, before the break, you mentioned the need for Southeast Asians to tell better stories about themselves, and you wrote a whole book about it called What It Takes, on the power of narratives and how people in your part of the world need to be more conscious, I guess, of who they are and translate or communicate that better to the world. Why would you need that? Because, I mean, putting aside the number of universities and the number of publications, in my country, and I'm sure around the world, many people know what Indonesia is about, what Malaysia is about. There's no sense of, you know, lack of knowledge. Perhaps there's a deficit in being more forceful in putting your interests across, both to China and the United States, but when it comes to representing your culture, it seems to be already on offer, is it not?
Yeah, I'm enlightened by the fact that you know the whereabouts of many parts of Southeast Asia, but I travel to quite a number of places around the world, and I've discovered that Many people around the world don't know where Penang is, where Malang is, where Chiang Rai is, where Cebu is. These are different towns or cities in different parts of Southeast Asia. And I think the empirical evidence to support, you know, the need for us to tell stories better is the lack of our ability to trade with each other. Just within Southeast Asia, the intra-trade is around 20 to 23% of the collective GDP. It's much lower than that of Europe, where they're trading with each other at a rate of more than 60% of the collective GDP. Intuitively, I would think, the lack of trading with each other in goods and services has to do with our inability to tell stories to each other. You know, within Southeast Asia, I mean, to the extent that you can actually tell stories to each other really well, you can understand what goods and services to send to each other that would be much more in complementarity as opposed to competition. And that, I think, would dovetail into much higher percentage as it relates to intra-trade. Now, it gets worse when you know, we have to tell the stories to beyond Southeast Asia. I mean, our economic relations with China are great at about $1 trillion worth of goods and services. With the U.S., it's only like $500 billion. I think those numbers could be more if we can tell stories better. And you go down the route of the investment route as it relates to foreign direct investment, you know, given the enormous liquidity that's, you know, sitting in many places around the world. Southeast Asia only gets about $200 to $230 billion worth of FDI per year, of which Singapore, it gets about $100 to $140 billion. You know, the others disproportionately a lot less than what Singapore gets. Indonesia, $30 billion. Malaysia, Vietnam, Thailand, and Malaysia each gets about 10 to 20 billion. I think that has some bearing on the degree to which each of these countries can tell stories, but it also has bearing on the lack of rule of law and the lack of translational capital.
Now, the part of the world that was the first to caught on to the importance of telling the story and capitalize on it was the West, particularly the United States. And I think right now they have come to a point where the Americans themselves are having a hard time to distinguish between authentic accounts, make-believe, marketing, and disinformation. When you talk about Southeast Asians needing to tell better stories and have more influence, what kind of stories do you have in mind, and what are they supposed to achieve?
Yeah, well, I'm not in the camp that believes that algorithmic amplification ought to be equated with democracy. I'm in the camp that believes that telling stories with numeracy and literacy should be the way to go for everybody in Southeast Asia. And that, I think, resonates to many parts of the Global South. The Global South represents about 84% of humanity, and I'm sure most parts of the Global South still don't tell their stories the way they should, by way of, you know, being shackled into this, you know, social media that I think has, equated algorithmic amplification with democracy, which I think is the wrong way to go forward with. I do believe that, you know, Indonesians and the others in Southeast Asia, They need to invest much more clearly on the non-tertiary education and the tertiary education. And I think the region needs to be more pronounced in producing STEM products. The region only produces about 750,000 STEM products per year, whereas India, 2 to 2.5, China, 4 to 4.5 million. I think the numbers are very telling in that Southeast Asia, if it wants to be a narrator in a much better way, I think it needs to improve upon its pre-existing educational attainment or lack thereof.
Now, we live in a time of borderless information flows, but at the same time, there are still notable cultural and philosophical differences in communication styles. The Western style, for example, is more direct, both in self-promotion and in attacking the other, whereas the Eastern tradition favors a more mellow, but I think more respectful and perhaps more equanimity-driven approach. Isn't there a danger of losing or compromising the latter in pursuing more of the former?
No, I'm not concerned about that. I think what needs to be educated to the masses in Southeast Asia would be to show an open, a higher degree of open-mindedness, which would be sine qua non for being able to combine the force of innovation with the force of preservation. The force of preservation relates to our tradition, our pre-existing culture, our orthodoxy. Those are preeminent, those are prominent features of our, footprint, which still would have to be combined with the force of innovation. I do believe that if we can show the necessary degree of open-mindedness as to combine those two forces, I think the trajectory for the region will be one of wisdom.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think countries like China or Russia, for that matter, that want to engage with Southeast Asia already have a pretty sophisticated country expertise. But what the Asian nations seem to crave the most is a reflection in the Western mirror. And I'm not sure it's an offer. To me, the West is like a one-way radio that's broadcasting its own content, but I'm not sure there is much interest for genuine understanding of the other, or even the sort of the capacity to do that. What do you think?
Well, I think the West has a good habit of, coming to the table with presupposition or predisposition, borderline lecturing, right? As opposed to other countries, particularly the Asian countries that come to the table, I think, with a huge degree of interest to listen and understand. That's the first observation. The second, I think the West has gone into this habit of thinking with conviction that they can write or rewrite history. And that, I think, doesn't resonate to many people around Southeast Asia. It does not resonate to many people in the global South. And that, I think, needs to change. I don't foresee Southeast Asia going in that direction. I foresee Southeast Asia going in a direction where we could actually, be, an added element of the conscience to the world, an added element of, hopefully embracing multipolarity with a higher degree of magnanimity, as opposed to the kind of multipolarity or even bipolarity or much less, unipolarity with a lot less magnanimity. So I think Southeast Asia, given its historical richness, will be able to contribute in a good way as long as we can tell stories better with literacy and numeracy. And that, I think, is a huge homework for many of us in Southeast Asia.
Now, Mr. Viryavan, you call education your own endgame, and you're hosting a very popular podcast by that name. You're also affiliated with many Western institutions, from Harvard to Yale to Stanford. Do you think those institutions offer enough educational value for the checks they take in, or indeed enough educational value to succeed in the kind of multipolar world that you've been talking about?
I'm actually at those places on a mission to bring about awareness of them with respect to Southeast Asia. I'm not there to extract. I'm there to actually, contribute, whatever wisdom I can with respect to Southeast Asia, which, as I alluded to earlier, is not as well known as it needs to be. I mean, you go to any part of California, 9 out of 10 times, you're not gonna find anybody or somebody that knows where Chiang Rai is, that knows where Cebu is, that knows where Malang is. More times than not, they'll know where Singapore is. That, I think, has bearing on the ability of the Singaporeans to tell stories to the world. So my mission there is not to extract, it's more to infuse, the imagination of anybody about what needs to be known about Southeast Asia. And I'm open-minded. I've been spending time in China lately, and I'd be very, very open to the idea of spending time in your part of the world, on the very similar mission of basically trying to, bring about more awareness with respect to Southeast Asia.
And finally, if I may ask you a more general question, because I think it applies to all of us, regardless of where we are in the world. You talk a lot about the need to democratize knowledge. And I think it's a very interesting subject to ponder. Is it only about intellect? Is it only about cognitive ability? How do arts and sports contribute to the so-called knowledge, let's say bodily knowledge or emotional knowledge? I know you yourself are a very versatile person in this regard. So how do you yourself decide what to give yourself to in order to become this fully rounded person?
Well, I think anywhere around the world, for anybody to be successful, he or she needs to have ambition, imagination, and serendipity. And serendipity, I think, is twofold, right? Whether it's smart luck or blind luck. Smart luck, I think, involves practicing. So for anybody to embrace imagination, ambition, and smart luck or smart serendipity, he or she needs to have a role model. A role model could be the head of household, the head of school, the head of office, the head of place of worship, or the head of social institutions. Unfortunately, in most parts of Southeast Asia, 80 to 90% of the households are headed up by somebody without a tertiary education. So the only hope is for the school to actually game change the narrative as it relates to education. So I think democratization of education relates to how anybody can infuse ambition, imagination, and smart serendipity. That could take place anywhere. And that, I think, relates to, you know, wisdom that needs to be embraced by anybody that wants to be successful, not just in telling stories, but I think in the context of bringing about relevance.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Viriyawan, we have to leave it there, but it's been an amazing conversation. Thank you very much for it.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.